Well, first of all, I think your book is wonderful.
Thank you.
And I was reading it, and it seems to me that it almost, I was drawing like a kind of a comparison to the current day Democratic Party. And I was worried because it seems that the Democratic Party ran away from the people. And the more I see it, it seems like Reagan preached, I think that he used to say, government is best when it governs less.
Right.
And that's one of the things I'm so proud to be a Republican, is that it's always been that way where we believe in the people, right, and that the people can make a decision, right, that we can respect, and that our money is best spent. That's a great tax cuts, and they're doing that. But it seems like they're taking down the mantle of what Lincoln ran with, and they're putting in place, and it concerns me, their ideals. And I think it's important, like, by the way, I hate to turn this into a abortion. I'm just one thing I heard the young lady speaking earlier.
Shut the hell up, fool. What are you talking about? One of the things you love about the raggedy-ass Republicans is how they have trust in the people. Well, is that why they're pushing forth this National ID Act called the Real ID Act? Where they're going to try to track down every movement that you make, from your DNA to your whole psychological profile. These are the same clowns, along with their Democratic allies, who pushed through the Patriot Act. That's trust in the people. They're the ones who are throwing in people into their gulags, day and night, disappearing people. That's trust in the people, right? They're the ones who are in the forefront of helping the corporations smash the rights of the people to hold these raggedy corporations accountable to the contracts that they are supposed to uphold. You know, like United Airlines. That's trust in the people. That's rhetoric. It's time to end that. You know what time it is. You're listening to 104.1, 106.7 Illinois, 101.1 Santa Cruz, 107.5 to the brothers and sisters out in North Carolina at Free Radio Asheville, LUBER.com, the world, RadioForAll.net, the universe, and Google into your Slave of Vote blog at Google Web Slave of Vote Radio. Find out what time it is. Tonight, we're going to shoot our way into the experience of an American G.I. Joe of Haitian background. G.I. Joe, Red, White, and Blue, and Shades of Color. And then a response to one of our listeners on Marla Rizika. So we got all that and a hell of a lot more on 104.1. Slave. Revolt.
Everything you know is wrong.
Hello, seekers, here we go again, and hello especially to the skeptic inside you who might still believe.
Believe.
You know what time it is now. Ruins of Empire. And tonight, what we're going to start off with is that as the body count of the Iraqi people and the U.S. G.I. Joe soldiers continues to rise, it's clear that the conditions and interests of Sam's toy soldiers is something that the rulers and the flag-waving patriots view as expendable. Philip Louis Jeanne, a U.S. Marine born in Haiti, but moved to New York at the age of 5, goes through some of his American experience at the hands of the beast. This is someone who thought that he was fighting for the red, white, and blue, but found out that he was going to have to fight for his own survival. It starts off where Felipe was approached by a young woman at the base where he was a soldier, and a little relationship started, and one night they decided to have a little oral sex at this military base. Felipe then describes the process of what started to go on with his life in the military as it expanded from there. So let's check out Felipe, the U.S. Marine's American experience. Dig this.
I was approached and arrested by Naval Criminal Investigative Services. When he first arrested me, he told me, "I can't tell you why." I said, "You're not taking me anywhere unless, you know, you tell me why you arrested me." He said, "You've been involved with a minor." I'm like, "What are you talking about?" He said, "You've been involved with a female under the age of 18. I'm like, "Wait, oh," and it clicked in my head, like, wow, you know. So and I was taken down to the station. He told me the female is, you know, is not new to the base. And this all happened on base, by the way, you know, Camp Pendleton, California. He told me, you know, this is a very small incident, and it's not going to get anywhere, you know. You'll probably get what's called a non-judicial punishment, which is basically a slap on the wrist, you know, because this female's known on the base for getting around. So, I mean, and that was that. This happened in January of 2002. To work out, like he said, you know, it actually got much bigger than that, what he said. August 1st of 2002, I was court-martialed in the Marine Corps for the incident. Battalion commander, he had a lot to do with what happened, you know, and this is a guy, you know, he's a, what we call an old-school Marine, meaning he was around during the hard days of the Marine Corps. Also during the racist days of the Marine Corps, from Texas. My charges when I was court-martialed was adultery, because at the time I was married. My wife and I were separated between ourselves. We didn't go ahead and make it a legal separation, but we were having problems, so we decided to go our separate ways. But for the military, because it was a legal separation or we weren't divorced, you're automatically charged with adultery, which means to have another person aside from your spouse, to be involved with another person. Now, everybody laughs at that. Yes, everybody laughs at that because nobody gets charged with adultery. The second charge was sodomy. Now, sodomy in the Marine Corps is any other position other than missionary position, meaning man on top of woman. So therefore, if with my own wife I were to engage in a sexual act and she were to lay down on top of me, and for some reason my commander found out, he could charge me for that, for sodomy, because I did not have it in the missionary position. Everybody laughs at that, because who's going to get charged? So you mean to tell me Everybody in the military has sex in the missionary position. Nobody does anything different but missionary position in the military. I mean, that's ridiculous, and nobody ever gets charged for those two charges, which I got charged for. So those were my actual charges.
So you can see what's happening. See, this helps explain or expose how, you know, all of these particular laws that they put in, these reactionary laws like sodomy and all of that, it's ridiculous, but it's for control. This is what these are based in. The sodomy laws, they can charge you with sodomy if you have sex in any other position other than the military position. Of course, this is completely ridiculous and reactionary and has its little roots in this whole, you know, puritanical Christian ethic and stuff like that. But they don't just use it on anyone because they know that their little popes and ministers and politicians and everyone else is doing everything under the sun to people. But when it came to this brother who didn't even know that this girl was underage, boom, they use it against her. And then since he was still married, even though he was separated, they conveniently use that against him also. In other words, here it helps expose how reactionary this society is and how it's helping set the seeds, fortunately, for its own destruction. Here's someone who's going out and joining their imperial forces, but they blind themselves with the racial issue, and they do everything they can to break him down. Now, some of these forces that come out and help uncover these facts are the same type of forces that produce the Hoovers of the world. You know, guys who are running around wearing dresses and stuff like that. So, once again, this helps expose that this is not about morality. This is simply about control. Now, next, Felipe explains how he took the deal when he found himself up against sodomy charges and adultery charges, and how his rank was reduced, and how, though, he still marched off like a good little Negro soldier. So check this out.
So I took the deal. I went to the military brig, and I was released September 7, 2002. I was sent to a new unit and trained in a new field. As a mortarman, because before this I was an infantry squad leader, so now they retrained me for mortarman because they needed that position for Iraq. Mortarman, if you ever watch the movies, you see when the guys are standing around a long tube and they take like a little rocket and they drop in the tube and cover their ears and duck and it pops right back up. That's a mortarman. So I was retrained as a mortarman. 5 months later, January of 2003, I deployed to Kuwait with my unit. Like practicing for a basketball game for 4 years and never getting to play this game. I mean, plus, you know, how much people say they actually fought for the country in combat. You know, and even though I was born in Haiti, I was raised in New York from the age of 5. All I know is America. You know, I don't know Haiti. So I, until the whole incident with immigration, I claimed America as mine. You know, I'm fighting for my country. You know, I considered America my country. After that, I like to, help people, basically. You know, protecting the country, that's helping everybody. That's how I look at it. Plus, of course, you get to travel. You know, I like to travel. Schooling. I'm not from a rich family. My family is actually very poor, so you know they would pay for my schooling. So that kind of pulled me towards the military.
All right. So once again, you see that they break him down from rank. He was a leader in his particular infantry squad leader. Now he's reduced to a mortarman. For this particular incident. Now, Think about all the rapes that are going on throughout the world by these G.I. Joes. Every time you turn around, they're capturing some little kid in Japan or someplace and doing everything under the sun. But somehow they're obsessed with breaking him down, yet he's still one of these cats who believes in the particular system, in a particular orthodoxy. He's still ready to fight for the invisible man in country. Now, and still believes, as you heard him say, that in protecting this country is helping everybody. So it helps expose that he has a lack of consciousness, and this helps make him even more vulnerable to this barbaric system. But next, let's move on as Felipe describes how he marches off to Kuwait and then Baghdad, John Wayne style.
Well, I'm deployed to Kuwait. I was given the option. I chose to go, and they said they'd love to have me go with them because I did have their experience. Even though I was lesser in rank, I did have the 4 years experience that a lot of those guys didn't have. So I went along with them, and basically we trained over there until the war was declared, and from there we moved from Kuwait to ultimately Baghdad. I don't know why, I just said, in my mind, I figured I wasn't coming back. I mean, that's just my personal, you know, that was my personal feeling at the time. I really didn't think I was coming back. Part of Regimental Combat Team 5, and amongst other regiments, and we were, everybody moved in different areas, of course, you know. We were the unit that was involved in taking over the palace. Saddam Hussein's palace. That was our ultimate goal. January, we left Iraq in May. In May, because my unit had to leave first because we were actually supposed to be in Japan at the time. So once the major fighting was done, at that point, once the palace, which was the objective, was secured, they sent our unit back first. So we came back in May of 2003, which would be, I guess, 5 months altogether. War, I mean, I think that hurt everybody that, you know, was close to me. I mean, everybody was stressed out. Basically, they didn't know if they were gonna get the news that, you know, hey, Philippe is dead. You know, I mean, at any moment that news could have came, and there was a long period of time where I wasn't able to call home, when none of us were able to call home for at least a month. My mother, she lost a lot of weight, you know. She wasn't eating. She started getting sick.
All right, so you can see what's happening. He still decides, after they dogged him out, to march off to a Kuwait in Baghdad. They accept him willingly because he has experience. Even though they reduced him in rank, they knew that he still had capabilities as an imperial fighter. So he goes off to Kuwait and Baghdad, and lingering in the back of his mind, though, is this kind of Negro fatalism. Because even though he's supposed to be going off fighting for red, white, and blue, God and country and all of that, he knows these guys are cutthroats. They've already dogged him. They've already sabotaged and started to sabotage as much as they could his particular life. So in the back of his mind, he's thinking, not only do I have to look out for these Iraqis that I'm about to go to war against, but I got to look out against this U.S. empire. It's the classic type of dual consciousness that many black people face in this particular society. So a form of fatalism starts to seep into him. And he feels isolated, like there's no place really to run. There's no nothing that he can really trust in this particular world, because he doesn't have a real class consciousness to have him examine what this U.S. empire is all about. This is just being grinded into him. Meanwhile, his mother, is becoming sick, and people are worrying because they don't hear about him for a month. They don't know what's going on. So the whole thing is snowballing on him as his life seems to be imploding. But then he gets out of Iraq. They seize Baghdad. He was part of that troop that goes in there, immediately seize Baghdad. So he was only there for 5 months. So he does his quote-unquote role as an imperial force for the U.S. Empire. And now he thinks that, okay, look, I played the hero role well. I've done what I was asked to do. All should be well, right? All should be skipping down the yellow brick road for me. But once again, the blackness is something he can't escape. Because as Felipe describes, he basically can't escape his past and, in America, the past.
I took, of course, a month to leave, so on, because I wasn't really able to function at that point. I only had one arm or so on. And my unit did deploy back to Japan, and I didn't go with them. They deployed in December. I was transferred to a new unit. But March 25th, I was brought into my company first sergeant's office to fill out some paperwork, supposedly. This first sergeant and company commander, those two, they had been giving me a hard time, which is why it took so long to get my promotion as well. They wanted to stop me in any way they can, you know, and they told me this personally, we're going to do anything in our power to stop you from being promoted because of what you did 2 years ago. I'm like, but sir, first sergeant, look what I've done since those 2 years. I've you know, been meritoriously promoted, and I've been to a war, you know, and I mean, what more do you want? I was punished already for that mistake, and look at my accomplishments now. And they went on to tell me they didn't believe I was promoted meritoriously, and they're gonna look into it, and they accused me of lying at first. They told me they believe I falsified my paperwork and so on. I'd heard about these two, and I kind of witnessed a little bit of what was going on, but once again, the whole racism issue, and I mean, believe it or not, it's still very much alive in the military, very much alive. It was more the new unit who didn't take the time to find out who I was and what my record was in the Marine Corps before. All they looked at is the fact that, hey, he was in trouble, that's all we need to know. And he's black. I mean, and I hate to say that, you know, but it is, you know, it is a reality. I mean, and once again, these two are, you know, I mean, I don't want to say the word, but I mean, I don't know any other ways to put it together. But I guess you could say Southern, you know, real Southern and redneckish, you know, type. And I don't know if I'm even allowed to say that, but they were. Thursday, March 19th of 2004. That night they came back, well, seems like everything checks out and you are lying. I said, what reason did I have to lie? I told you I am one of the best Marines you've probably ever seen. It's just I messed up at one point. I made a mistake. You guys have made mistakes at some point in your lives. They said, yes, but just not this big though. I mean, and that same day, they did advise me that, you know, we called immigration. Immigration has a warrant out for your arrest. I laughed, of course, because in my mind, I was automatically a citizen because I just came back from a war. I misunderstood it at that time, but the president had issued what's called an executive order stating that any non-citizen who's in the military will be expedited. Their citizenship applications will be expedited, and certain requirements they don't have to meet. So I figured I was automatically a citizen. That's what everybody said. Oh, you're automatically a citizen because you just fought, took arms for the country. So I laughed, you know, I was like, how could you tell me, you know, I have a warrant? They know where I'm at. I was just in the office about 2 weeks ago. So how come they didn't arrest me then? And he was, of course, upset. He was like, well, that's just what we heard. That's what they told us. I'm like, oh, well, they know where I'm at.
So here, these clowns, first, they don't want to believe that he, quote unquote, did a good job for the imperialist machine. While he was over there in Baghdad, which basically meant that he killed up and shot up and blew up the people that they told him to efficiently. But they don't want to believe the accomplishments, and they latch on to the fact that he had been in trouble, quote unquote, with that underage girl who he didn't know was underage 2 years ago, and that he was already demoted for. But they can't let it go. They could, but they don't want to let it go. This is just an excuse to break him down. So after he goes off to fight in this little G.I. Joe Imperial War, they end up calling immigration on him. And this is helped by the fact that all the right wingers, the Democrats and Republicans, and all of this yelping for tougher immigration standards, let's get tough on crime, and that whole stuff that they parlay out, they've helped create an atmosphere where you as an immigrant could be kicked out of the country under this war on terrorism for the slightest grievance whatsoever. So the standards have been corroded even more than they already were. So here, this one cat who's fought for the imperial machine is still in the military, just gets back from his duties, and his upper echelon commandos are looking for an excuse and actually actively trying to get him jackbooted out of the country, which helps expose once again their contempt for blackness and their contempt for disposable G.I. Joes. They don't have any respect for these clowns. These guys are just disposable entities that after they play their part, even if they're not completely finished, they'll kick them to the curb. And this is in the midst of the military having a shortage. They're in crisis over their numbers. And you still have these yahoos trying to get Felipe kicked out of the country. It's not enough to get him booted out of the military. They want him out the damn country. Now next, Felipe explains the next move against him by his fellow Marines.
I was sitting out in front of the first sergeant's door, and the company commander, he was not there at the moment, but I heard the first sergeant saying, oh, I have Lujan up front. Oh yeah, I told him just come fill out some paperwork, so I have him waiting out there. Oh, I have a crew coming. Yeah, it's a 3-man crew, I believe. They're coming. So automatically, I knew something was going on. But I knew I hadn't done anything wrong. And, you know, I have nothing to be afraid of. So I just wanted to see what they were up to. So he's like, I have a three-man crew coming. And the next thing he said, I don't know, Tijuana? He starts laughing. So, of course, my assumption is that the commander must have asked him, where am I going to be deported to? That's why he answered, I don't know, Tijuana. And he started laughing. And that was it. So I waited there, and about 20 minutes later, an immigration officer came in, and they pulled me into the office. They told me for the incident that took place in 2002, I'm found removable from America. And I said, that's impossible. Both my parents are American citizens. I'm married to an American citizen, and I just came from a war for the country. So all those things make me a citizen automatically. He said, no, you're not. He's like, you are removable. Just put your hands behind your back. I kind of smiled. He's like, no, I'm not joking. Put your hands behind your back. You are under arrest. And that was on March 25th of 2004. And I sat in a San Diego correctional facility from that day until January 28th of 2005. 10 months and 3 days. If I would have died over there in Iraq, though, I would have been given my citizenship then, posthumously. If I would have died, but because I didn't die, oh well, you can't get it. That's how it works. So in death, you get your citizenship over there. I believe at one point the president issued a citizenship to a Mexican Marine who had died over there, issued to his parents after he was dead, you know. I was there, you're a prisoner. That's it, you're a prisoner, you're nothing. One of the officers, he had recently got out of the Marine Corps, and he started working there. He would come over and talk to me, you know, because we were the same rank. But, I mean, they basically treated you like you were nothing. Hey, you know, shut up, get over here, blah, blah, blah. And they treat you like you're nothing, really, you're nothing. They talk to you like you're a little kid. I mean, I'm a grown man. My accomplishments are probably more than yours. What that officer that would speak to me, what he told me, this is what they're taught in class, is that we're second-class citizens. All we do is we complain about everything, and most of us are getting deported anyway, so you know what, just deal with them. And you know, that's what he told me he learned in his class while he was going through school. That's the general attitude. That everybody there is nothing. We're just waiting to be deported. As a green card holder, who commits a crime, which is considered a felony, is subject to deportation. Now, the thing with me, my crime was not a felony. I had a lawyer send a letter to immigration saying that in the military, these charges, adultery and sodomy, which is oral sex, is not a felony. They're not considered felonies in the Marine Corps. You don't get 37 days in a jail for a felony. 37 days. No, that doesn't happen. But for immigration, they have the right to determine whatever crimes they feel as a felony. So they actually used the sodomy crime, you know, which was oral sex, to try to deport me. That's what they used to try to deport me. Well, I mean, if it's a crime for you to, you know, receive oral sex in America, then most of us should be in jail, I guess.
Now, it's clear once again how these reactionary laws play a role in emboldening and empowering the state. These raggedy immigrationists, you know, the INS and all of that type of stuff, have a different standard of control that they can enforce upon immigrants. So oral sex, which is just basically oral sex, and it's not even really a crime, they can call sodomy, and it had the right to charge you as a felon under their immigration laws, which don't coincide with the regular laws within particular society. So they're given extrajudicial power to pulverize their desired targets. Now, this is after the first commander has set up the process for Felipe to get booted out of the country. Here's someone who had been involved in this incident and demoted for this incident in 2002. So once again, it exposes the laws passed by the right-wing forces is designed to keep people under crushing pressure, terror, etc., etc. Now, juxtapose Felipe with someone like Boy George. Here, Boy George, who was too scared to go into the real military, he skirts out into this National Guard stuff. He's getting high all the time, playing around, not showing up to even the little National Guard service on the days he's supposed to. But you don't see this whole state apparatus come down crushing on him, because it's not designed to come crushing down on people of Boy George's class stature. This is used for the disposable. So then you have a situation where one of the guys who works as a guard tells Felipe that they're taught and trained to treat the deportees, the immigrants, as subhuman. Now, just oppose this with the rhetoric that you hear the right now, O'Reilly, Hannity and Combs, all of these little patriot types with the flag up there behind, as they babble on about honor our troops, all this type of junk. They're still steaming mad at Jane Fonda over the incident and over the Vietnam incident and stuff. But as one can see, this has the double class standard, and it's all racially coded. You don't see them making an outcry for their G.I. Joe who's colored the wrong way. These guys are hypocrites. They're exploiters. They're this part of the beast apparatus.
Yeah, but Trace, you know something I see in this? I believe that it sounds like that racist first sergeant was the one that called immigration.
Felipe said that he called immigration, and the excerpt I played right before that, they told Felipe, which Felipe said over the air, that they told him that they called immigration.
Now check this out. That being the case, just like in the police where they have these little racist gangs or the Ku Klux Klan is penetrated, that same thing is happening in the military.
Well, that's part of the point of this whole thing, to expose that these guys, even in the midst of their own particular crisis, here, they're getting their G.I. Joes shot up. They're having more and more trouble to recruit stooges to join their imperial forces, yet they're so blinded in part by their own racism that they're slaughtering and kicking out people who are willing to go fight for the empire.
Yeah, but that to that extent, to actually have some old Ku Kluxers or Minutemen or whatever working together and calling each other up and framing up. What do you need to know about the military to want to join when you hear stuff like this?
Now next, Felipe describes his new predicament in Sam's justice system.
After 5 months, the immigration judge found me deportable. The immigration judge did deport me. Of course, my heart, you know, nearly stopped. But I wasn't surprised either, you know. I mean, I was kind of expecting it. I was hoping it wouldn't happen, but kind of expected it. That was about it. And the judge ordered me deported. And of course, I was scared and I was frustrated. I said, you know, I was not even going to fight at one point, which was appeal. I decided not to even appeal at one point, you know. No, right after the judge ordered me deported, I said I was not going to appeal. I called my mother and my father. I said, look, I'm going to just get deported because I can't be here any longer. I know 5 months of my life is already wasted. And really, for a country, if after what I've given to this country, I could say I've given to this country more than a majority of anyone, any true American, naturally born American, could ever claim. You know, to have done for this country, I could claim. I joined the military for this country, and then I went to war for this country. And a lot of people can't claim that, you know. A lot of true Americans cannot say that, but I could. And if after all that, this country's gonna say I'm not worth it to be in this country, I don't deserve to be in this country, then I really don't want to be here anyway.
Well, it's clear, Felipe, they don't want you here either. This is part of the crushing reality of Sam's brutality that can't be escaped from the racial component. And for it so real and potent that even ones like Felipe can't hide in complete la-la mythical land. It's just there in your face, pounding. So now he's at a state of, well, this let me leave, you know, they don't want me, you know, I've done everything I could for them, fight their imperialist war, but I can't escape the blackness, so let me just get on the hell out. See, this is the reality that black people live. There is no fairy tale ending in America for us. It can often get distorted and glossed over by the way they in the corporate media will focus in on, you know, celebrities, bling bling Negroes, these little entertainers dancing and showing their little cars and all of that type of stuff, pushing out people like Cosby and Armstrong Williams, you know, this con men, shufflers, jivers. But just an ordinary everyday brother like Felipe, confused, abused, there's no escaping the real blackness. Next, Felipe describes the technicality that played a part in his immigration status. Let's find out what that is.
Because there was a mistake during the DA, the district attorney, they made a mistake, which my lawyer pointed out. They didn't certify my documents. My documents were not certified, and according to the Board of Immigration, all paperwork has to be certified, all documentation, conviction documents, they have to be certified. Mine weren't. And they said because of this, you know, we terminate the case. So you could basically say that was a technicality. I was released January 28th of this year, nearly a year. That's the thank you for serving the country. That's the thank you we get as a non-American citizen, I guess. This is not finished yet. I still have a long ways to go. And I'm afraid to be in New York, which is why I'm not going to stay in New York too much longer. Because immigration at any point here, they could come and pick me up again, basically detain me again, because in California, there's a law preventing them from fixing their mistake and coming and getting me again. But I will still have to continue fighting for my immigration, for my citizenship. Because right now, I just have a green card. And if I apply for citizenship, they're going to say, you know what, you won your case, but you won based on a technicality, not for any legal reason. You won because we made a mistake, so therefore we're going to deny you citizenship. That's most likely what's going to happen. So now once this happens, I have to appeal, and then appeal to the district court, and maybe appeal to the Supreme Court, California Supreme Court. And that could take over 2, 3, 4 years to do, 5 years to do. By that time, my green card would have already run out. And when I try to reapply for green card, they might deny me on that too, and then give me the boot.
So once again, you hear how Felipe's trapped, how he's caught. He's looking all over his shoulder from the immigration. If they deport him, he's going to be looking over his shoulder from the death squads in Haiti that Sam has set up over there. Earlier, he was looking over his shoulder from the U.S. military as they were after his throat with the Kluxers. He went off like a confused G.I. Joe over to Iraq, so he had to look over his shoulder against the Iraqis. He feels hemmed in by the whole world because of his misinterpretation of the class and racial component and how it truly plays out. It's getting grinded home to him. But unless he understands it or gets to understand it in its totality, he'll forever be looking over his shoulder instead of a slave in revolt and realize that his gun should be pointed at those who originally pointed at him. How did he get to Haiti in the first damn place? Those are some of the questions he should be asking. But he then goes on to talk about how, you know, he basically got out of this little immediate turmoil because the papers weren't certified. The judge said, get out. You're out. But over some little technicality, he's temporarily out. But he's looking over his shoulder. Like I said, once again, he wants to get out of New York because of the status that they can just, boom, light him back up. That's his plight as a slave for the imperial forces. But, you know, I know that some of our listeners are probably thinking or saying in the back of their mind, well, how do you know it's really racial? How do you know Felipe was really being persecuted off of a racial component?
It was a Marine from my unit, from the same unit that I was in. I didn't recognize him, but he recognized me. I was going up the stairs, and he said, Louis Jean. I turned around, said, how do you know me? He's like, because I'm in your unit. I'm like, what? He said, yeah. He's like, First Sergeant got me, too. He's like, First Sergeant got me, too. He was from Venezuela. He said, yeah, the First Sergeant got me, too. He's like, after you left, First Sergeant started calling immigration on anybody who was not American. There was another African Marine. He's like, oh yeah, he called immigration on G, but G was a citizen already. Immigration came and started bugging him, and he had his paperwork, he had his certificate, he's a citizen. And he went to the office and said, look, First Sergeant, stop calling immigration on me, I'm a citizen. This is what this Marine told me. He said he called immigration on several other people who were already citizens. He's like, yeah, he's going haywire over there. He's calling immigration on any non-American. Now, if that's not racism, plain and bold, what is. And I believe some legal action needs to be taken against this First Sergeant. Hopefully, you know, somebody would, you know, maybe on your radio show will hear this and, you know, tell me how I can, you know, pursue this First Sergeant, you know, and what he's doing.
Go after him in a class conscious organized way. Look, when Felipe is talking about non-American, he's also talking about it in the component of how this little commando sees it. You're non-American if you're non-white. He attacks the Latin dude, the African dude, the Afro-Haitian Felipe. Now, this helps expose that this is not about the quote-unquote crime that Felipe had committed 2 years prior, you know, when he was brought up on the sodomy adultery charges, because these guys weren't involved in any quote-unquote indiscretion. This is clean the house of the darkies. This is how it works in the real world. It won't be covered on Fox News and, you know, Michael Savage and all of that junk, because they're still playing into the mythological structure and belief systems that many people want to adhere to within this society. Now, Felipe himself wants to kind of play, or at one time he did want to play into this mythological game of what America stood for. But that crushing reality has made him realize that the Iraqis are Haitian and he's an Iraqi. That's the real world. But to show you how the shameless U.S. military machine is not only not finished with Felipe, it truly, truly has no shame at all.
Several weeks back, my mother received a phone call, and she gave me the number, and I called them, and they asked me if I want to, because, you know, a lot of people are being recalled right now, you might as well voluntarily reactivate yourself, voluntarily re-enlist for another couple of years, you know, because I still have 3 years on contract as an inactive reservist. Now, being an inactive reservist, they could call me at any time they want in the Marine Corps and tell me we're sending you back to Iraq. And I can't say no, because if I say no, I signed the contract, so they could arrest me and put me in the brig again. So they still, Marine Corps still has control over my life, and they could still call me and send me back to Iraq to go die for America after all this has happened, and I have no say-so.
You do have a say-so. Realize your position. Drop your illusions and organize with like-minded people in a similar situation. When I say like-minded, those who are in the same class situation as you are, and realize that Sam is your enemy. Don't fight for Massa. Fight for the slaves. Become a slave in revolt instead of a slave in collaboration with the imperial state. It can't be any more clear to what you're going through than this. These beasts are your enemies. They joke about it. They laugh about it. And in the meantime, they're doing what they can to crush your soul and what remaining dignity you may have. Hold on a sec.
Check this out. Those of Jewish blood, regardless of their assimilation, intermarriage, religious activity, or even conversion to Christianity. Only after Jews were identified could they be targeted for asset confiscation, ghettoization, deportation, and ultimately, extermination. To search generations of communal church and governmental records all across Germany and later throughout Europe was a cross-indexing task so monumental it called for a computer. But in 1933, no computer existed. When the Reich needed to mount a systematic campaign of Jewish economic disenfranchisement, and later began the massive movement of European Jews out of their homes and into ghettos, once again, the task was so prodigious, it called for a computer. But in 1933, no computer existed. When the final solution sought to efficiently transport Jews out of European ghettos along railroad lines and into death camps with timing so precise the victims were able to walk right out of the boxcar and into a waiting gas chamber, the coordination was so complex a task, this too called for a computer. But in 1933, no computer existed. However, another invention did exist. The IBM punch card and card sorting system, a precursor to the computer. IBM, primarily through its German subsidiary, made Hitler's program of Jewish destruction a technologic mission the company pursued with chilling success. IBM Germany, using its own staff and equipment, designed, executed, and supplied the indispensable technological assistance Hitler's Third Reich needed to accomplish what had never been done before, the automation of human destruction. More than 2,000 such multi-machine sets were dispatched throughout Germany, and thousands more throughout Nazi-dominated Europe. Card sorting operations were established in every major concentration camp. People were moved from place to place, systematically worked to death, and their remains cataloged with icy automation. IBM Germany, known in those days as Deutsche Hollerith Maschinengesellschaft, or Dehomag, did not simply sell the Reich machines and then walk away. IBM's subsidiary, with the knowledge of its New York headquarters, enthusiastically custom designed the complex devices and specialized applications as an official corporate undertaking. Dehomag's top management was comprised of openly rabid Nazis who were arrested after the war for their party affiliation. IBM New York always understood from the outset in 1933 that it was courting and doing business with the upper echelon of the Nazi Party. Indeed, the company leveraged its Nazi Party connections to continuously enhance its business relationship with Hitler's Reich in Germany and throughout Nazi-dominated Europe. Dehomag and other IBM subsidiaries custom-designed the applications. Its technicians sent mock-ups of punch cards back and forth to Reich offices until the data columns were acceptable, much as any software engineer would do today. Punch cards could only be designed, printed, and purchased from one source, IBM. Machines were not sold, they were leased, and regularly maintained and upgraded by only one source, IBM. IBM subsidiaries trained the Nazi officers and their surrogates throughout Europe, set up branch offices and local dealerships throughout Nazi Europe, staffed by a revolving door of IBM employees, and scoured paper mills to produce as many as 1.5 billion punch cards per year in Germany alone. Moreover, the fragile machines were serviced on site about once per month, even when that site was in or near a concentration camp. I have long been haunted by a question whose answer has long eluded historians. The Germans always had the lists of Jewish names. suddenly a squadron of grim-faced SS would burst into a city square and post a notice demanding those listed assemble the next day at the train station for deportation to the east. But how did the Nazis get the lists? For decades, no one has known. Few have even asked. The answer? IBM Germany's census operations and similar advanced people counting and registration technologies. IBM was founded in 1896 by German inventor Hermann Hollerith as a census tabulating company. Census was its business. But when IBM Germany formed its philosophical and technological alliance with Nazi Germany, census and registration took on a new mission. IBM Germany virtually invented the racial census, listing not just religious affiliation, but bloodline, going back generations. This was the Nazi data lust, not just to count the Jews, but to identify them. How much did IBM know? Some of it, IBM knew on a daily basis throughout the 12-year Reich. The worst of it, IBM preferred not to know. Don't ask, don't tell was the order of the day. Yet IBM New York officials, and frequently Watson's personal representatives, Harrison Chauncey and Werner Lear, were almost constantly in Berlin or Geneva, monitoring activities, ensuring that the parent company in New York was not cut out of any of the profits or business opportunities Nazism presented. When U.S. law made such direct contact illegal, IBM's Swiss office became the nexus, providing the New York office continuous information and credible deniability. What made me demand answers to the unasked questions about IBM and the Holocaust? I confronted the reality of IBM's involvement one day in 1993 in Washington at the United States Holocaust Museum. There, in the very first exhibit, an IBM Hollerith T11 card sorting machine, riddled with circuits, slots, and wires, was prominently displayed. Clearly affixed to the machine's front panel, listened an IBM nameplate. The exhibit explained little more than that IBM was responsible for organizing the German census of 1933 that first identified the Jews. IBM had been tight-lipped about its involvement with Nazi Germany. So although 15 million people, including most major Holocaust experts, have seen the display, and in spite of the best efforts of leading museum historians, little more was understood about this provocative display other than the brief curator's description at the exhibit and a few pages of supportive research. I still remember staring at the machine for an hour, and the moment when I turned to my mother and father, who accompanied me to the museum that day, and promised them I would discover more. My parents...
Attention! Seekers everywhere! I was right! Everything I knew was wrong!
You see, where they've gone, they're playing with the universe. They're playing with the solar system.
Alright, as we wrap this up, we're going to go into a Beyond the Shadow segment that deals with one of our listeners, a brother named Singh, who had written in to the Slave blog and had some questions and observations concerning a couple of our shows. He first thanks the us for having the show and talks about it was informative and how the martial law and the black experience was very insightful for him on the issue of race and class order and, you know, things that black people have experienced and other people kind of just ignore. But then he had a couple of comments about another segment that dealt with Marla Rizicka, which is the May 24th show. It was Marla Rizicka's, you know, humanitarian imperialism. You could check it out on the Slave blog. And I'm going to answer some of his questions and concerns that he had and let us slaves kind of hopefully work it all out. The brother first says that, quote, "I had a couple of comments, questions, about your show, Empire in Ruins 524. At first I was put off by your critique of Marla Rizicka. Perhaps I wanted to view her in the way that Democracy Now! And other activists portrayed her as a martyr for our side, whatever our side is. In the end, I was glad that you offered this critique, though I still think you could have treated this issue more sensitively. True, she did collaborate with the imperialist state. True, she did provide the same state with information. But come on, how vital was her information to the interests of the military? I have strong doubts that information about injured Iraqi widows, butchered children, etc., was of vital tactical importance to the U.S. state. But what should she have done? What could she have done differently? How else could she have helped those injured by this imperialist state? How else could she have drawn attention to those who are normally invisible? These questions are not meant to be rhetorical. I'm anxious to hear alternatives." So, first off, let me address some of these questions. There's more, but start off that the brother has raised. You know, one of the things that we have to kind of examine and always kind of keep in focus is the fact that the imperial state is always going to try to keep our eyes off the prize, so to speak. You know, not too long ago, a general strike broke out in Basra. And this was after the British troops themselves tried to install some notorious little ex-Ba'athist party leader as the mayor. Things went into an uproar. And one of the oil field technicians, Hassan Juma Oswald, he's been deeply involved in the southern oil fields as a union worker for three decades. He understood what was going on and realized that one of the big obstacles that the U.S. empire was going to have in trying to control the Iraqi population overall and its land and resources was dealing with the unions themselves. He himself talked about how they're trying to there's a privatization effort of the country's oil. Now, the Iraqis in Iraq, the oil is basically the lifeblood. The southern fields produce about 80%. Now, similar to how the oil workers in Iran played a key role in bringing down the Shah, the empire of America knows that a key component of the strength of the Iraqi population are the oil workers. This is what Oswald had to say. Quote, "Without organizing ourselves, we would have been unable to protect our industry, which we had been looking after for generations. It was our duty as Iraqi workers to protect the oil installations since they are the property of the Iraqi people. And we are sure that the U.S. and international companies have come here to put their hands on the country's oil reserves." Now, he's right. Now, who did they first come up against? Halliburton. Halliburton then set up their little subsidiary. It was called KBR. And what KBR did was, who got the contract through a no-bid contract, they hired a Kuwaiti subcontractor. And they, of course, their name is Al Khurafi. And they already had hundreds of foreign employees ready to do the work of the Iraqi people, the Iraqi workers that are already there. Now, them being faced with replacement workers already on the already to take over the few jobs that they have and a key component. This is in a city where unemployment is at 70% because of the imperial invasion. AWOD and company stood, the union workers, stood at the crossroads at the fight against the empire. They're not talking about any of this type of stuff in the corporate media or, you know, and all of that type of stuff. And what ended up happening was Awad said this, quote, "Iraq will be reconstructed by Iraqis. We don't need any foreign interference." Now, first they tried to cut a deal and split the jobs with the Iraqis, but the oil workers refused to accept any outside help. This emblazoned the situation even more. So then the occupation administration ordered what was called Order 30. Now, this lowered the base wages for the Iraqi public sector workforce, including the oil workers, from $60 a month to $35 a month. And it also cut subsidies for food and housing. So here the workers are seeing, look, these imperial forces that are already occupying, they're trying to cut what little wages we have and break us down. Now, the reason why I mentioned some of this is, as Brother Singh asked, what could she have done differently? Well, part of the thing that Marla could have done was she could have sided with the struggle that was ongoing and is ongoing with the Iraqi union and oil workers there that are fighting tooth and nail against the imperial forces that are trying to crush them. See, the people over the planet, the darkies all over the planet, they don't need this Mother Teresa model where you have these little Mother Teresas from America come and hand out donkey chips that are given to us from the by the likes of her, where she gets them from the imperial forces. See, the Iraqi people understand that, and union workers understand that they're in the grips of a major battle, and that one of their key components of strength and vitality is control over the Iraqi oil fields. So this is where they're fighting tooth and nail. So then Juma Awad says, quote, "We ask ourselves, how can it be that workers in our industry would get $35 a month? The American administration wasn't willing to cooperate with us, so we had a short strike. We managed to get the minimum salary up to 150,000 Iraqi dinars, or about $100. In other words, they used their class force to push it beyond what they were getting from the start, which was 60, didn't allow it to be broke down to 35, pushed it up to 100. Then he said, "This was the beginning of our struggle to improve the income of oil workers." At that point, the union effectively doubled the wages of many of the workers all over the region. Now, workers, laborers who have 20 years experience earn about 420,000 Iraqi dinars. That's about $300 a month. Now, a chicken in the market costs 1,500 dinars. So in other words, it costs about a dollar. So in other words, what they saw was that the battle deals with how diligently they defend their particular class interests. Forcibly and by their labor collaboration struggle within the masses. Now, this is when you see the vitality of a particular sector of the society that is starting to work out its own programs, so on and so forth. Now, if Marla and other types had worked with people like this, this is where you can put in your program that, first of all, give us the $9 billion that you stole. give it to the people and let them, through their trade unions and what have you, and organizations, disperse it out as they see fit. And they can use the leverage that they have as a class force to actually impose that on the imperial state, not come, you know, crawling like Marla, which is basically a donkey chip type of mentality of handouts, and you playing the Mother Teresa type of role. So now what is going on, as Awad says, is that, quote, now we have worker councils in 23 areas of southern Iraq, and they represent over 23,000 workers, unquote. Now, this is something crucial developing. Now, the fact that they're not talking about it doesn't mean it's not going on. It means that they don't want you to think outside of the boundaries of just the kind of chaotic suicide bombings and all of that type of stuff. See, this is the development of a possibility for a break of class consciousness in the region to develop, where the people will organize in their particular class interests, not under religious lines, not under particular narrow defined ethnic lines, but their overall interests, because all of them are being pulverized. But see, there's a mentality in this particular society where you see people, they go off into these, what they're exotifying us, is basically what I'm saying. They go off to Africa, they go off to Guatemala, India, Palestine, Iraq, and they say, you know, look at all these darkies over there, they're struggling, and so on and so forth. And then they latch on to the imperial structure to get little stipends to hand out. Now, if you're an Iraqi mother and your home has been blown up and or whatever, what else are you going to say to a Marla except thanks? I mean, because you're not in any real position of power. But the whole region is being pulverized, and that type of person has a type of situation where she can, I'm not talking about Marla, I'm talking about the Iraqi mother and others, they have a force over there where their organic power can be raised on a class conscious level to help battle against the state. What Marla was doing is a perpetuation of this type of Mother Teresa syndrome, where you go out to the colored worlds and hand out donkey chips instead of working with the people within their power base. Now, this is also a situation where it's, see, Marla, also like others, they can come down or could have come down with us to these military registration areas and help us pass out head coffins to those who were thinking about going into the military, to help explain that that's your future, being having your head sawed off by some angry Iraqi and thrown into one of our head coffins that we make here in West Oakland. Now, that's not a real future. So maybe you want to think about something else. You know, I mean, that's the real world. But see, once again, many of these Marla types don't like to see themselves working in collaboration where they're not the quote-unquote majority. There's something psychologically going on. Because see, the majority of the people who are being recruited into these little squadrons of imperial military destitute are people of color. Yet she lives in the same country where this apparatus is going. This is how they keep their military machinery going. So why not stop that military machinery where it has, where it's recruiting and sucking the lifeblood in these rural areas, and especially in these communities of color? But see, that means you're not going to be the head honcho. You're not going to be the Mother Teresa. Also, turn into the Iraqi working class and those elements fighting physically and intelligently against the forces. You're not going to lead. You can't play Mother Teresa in that situation.
You know what? There's one more thing I just want to mention, Trace. I think you covered one side of it very aptly. But this Marla, this humanitarian and imperialist, walking around, you know, giving up information to the powers that be in Iraq today, where we talk about that information could lead to the arrest, for instance, of a resistance fighter. Oh, yeah. We don't know all of the type of information that she carried around. Is she a martyr? Well, for whom? She might be a martyr for the red, white, and blue, but not me and you. That kind of collaboration, when you collaborate with the powers that be, you are taking a side. And in her case, as Tracy pointed out, it's the wrong side. It's the side of historical reaction. Now, the gentleman points out in his little letter, he says, well, what real damage did she do? All she did was give information about the Iraqis and how many people got killed and the families and stuff. First of all, information is power. The less Sam knows, the better off the oppressed are. We don't want them to know nothing about what's going on in Iraq. So he turned the wrong corner. Bladang. See, there is indeed a very serious consequence to giving up what she may have even thought might have been casual information to the powers that be that are torturing people. She don't know how many people were arrested based on the information she gave up. There's no such thing as harmless information in a war. So what's the tactical importance of the information? Wait a minute. What's the tactical information, importance of the information? We can't clearly say here at this point. But what we can say, is there anything else she could have done? What was really bad, what she did was provide a negative model to confuse liberals that are opposed to the war. That this is a way to work, in a humanitarian way against war. It is not. She was working for imperialism, and that's the problem.
Now, next, the brother Singh asks, she says that I'm anxious to hear about alternatives. She was on the ground in Iraq. She met those who suffered the effects of this imperial nation. She saw these people as people and genuinely cared for their well-being. And she had a greater understanding of their suffering than the activists who stay in this country. She had more of an understanding of their suffering than you do because she was there. Because she met them and looked into their eyes. And while it's hypocritical and absurd for the imperialist state that attacked and robbed these people to offer a portion of these victims a trifling compensation, is she a hypocrite? Okay, now, let me go on and address what this brother has to say on that. First of all, when he talks about she has a better understanding, just because she was physically there doesn't mean that she has a better or more thorough understanding. And on top of that, never underestimate where a slave revolt is coming from over its overall analysis on some of this type of stuff. A friend of mine who was there named Christian Parente. Now, Christian Parente worked with me on some of these types of issues concerning radio in the past. He was the one who took a slave revolt over to Radio X, which is the Mission District station that existed at one time in San Francisco before it was crushed by the FCC. So Christian Parente used to live in the Bay Area. Now he lives in New York. He has several books out. One's called Soft Cage. One's called Lockdown America. He has another one called The Freedom, Shadows and Hallucinations in Occupied Iraq that he just released. Well, it turns out that Christian interviewed Marla Rozicka. This is what he has to say in his book about Marla. Quote, Marla Rozicka is one of the occupation's NGO, non-governmental organization, groupies. She is the type who gets 10% of that 10% that trickles down to the ground. Known for her dyed blonde hair and flashy style, Marla is talking up the fact that she has leveraged $10 million from the U.S. government, so her organization, Civic, can aid, quote-unquote, the victims of U.S. military action. She and Civic and the U.S. occupation authorities do not use the term compensate because that would imply American culpability. The U.S. government maintains that because Iraq is a war zone, its military is not legally liable when it kills innocents, and so the operative verb is aid. I interviewed Marla at the Hotel Ajdir, a dive favored by Eastern European journalists and broke American freelancers. It turns out that Marla hasn't actually received 10 million USAID captures and grants, and the money will not actually be dispersed as aid to the survivors of U.S. military actions, but will instead be spent on unspecified development projects that will indirectly aid quote-unquote war victims. When I press Marla further, it turns out that Civic is directly serving only five families who have been quote-unquote negatively impacted, unquote, by U.S. military operations. Unquote.
Don't so, need no more than that. That's
so right here, this shows that, as Kristen exposed, that this is all a fraud. This is not even real. You know, Marla was operating in a fantasy. It was all smoke and mirrors. And unfortunately, much of the progressive movement that likes to see itself in the forefront of these type of particular actions and likes to play the Mother Teresa syndrome did not do their job in analyzing honestly the role that she played. And started
which includes democracy now.
And question just exactly what are you doing on the ground. So as you said, Singh, when you talked about she had more of an understanding of their suffering than you do because she was there and because she looked them into the eyes. Well, the fact of the matter is that she was looking into their eyes with blinders on. Or with red, white, and blue glasses that were prescribed to her by the Imperial forces. It was all a fraud. Now, at the same time, we see a situation where the U.S. military is being built up as, quote, the apotheosis of all that is great and good about contemporary America, quote, unquote. This writes Boston University professor Andrew Bolshevich, a retired Army colonel. But at the same time, they are facing the worst recruitment crisis since the military draft was ended during the end of the Vietnam War. Quote, Army recruiting is in a death spiral, unquote, retired Army Lieutenant Colonel Charles Crone has said. Now, so the reason why I mention this is that these guys are finding themselves in a crisis situation. Many of them knew that they were going to be in a serious situation. They needed more than 140, 150,000 men to subdue Iraq. But for political reasons and because they didn't want to start the draft, they only had, you know, the limited amount that they had. Now they find themselves in a crisis. They are under-supporting the troops. The corporations are going wild, ripping off the population, stealing money. Troops are undergunned, running out of ammo, not protected right, becoming demoralized. Things are going chaotic. And the portions of the Iraqi insurgents are seizing the time, and the Iraqi workers are seizing the particular time. Now, the reason why I mention this is that this is a real understanding of the situation that goes on, and that the perpetuation of what the U.S. military killing machine is doing is not going to be halted by aligning with them. Is going to be crushed by a vibrant developing movement that takes place, hopefully, within the Iraqi population at the base of their strength. Now, you know, Marla could have drawn attention to these situations by supporting and publicizing these types of elements that are going on within the vibrant working class. When you have 23,000 union workers that are facing down not only the U.S. military machine, because the military machine is in a precarious situation, but it's also doing battle and having its leaders of, you know, the Union attacked by the insurgent forces, because many of them are reactionary and just want everything in particular forms of chaos. And, you know, many of them are just as pro-capitalist as Boy George. It's not that they don't mind the capitalist privatized model, many of these insurgent type of forces. They just want you bending down to Allah so that they could privatize the land up, as opposed to the imperialist forces privatizing the land up. But the union workers and many other working forces, they just want a clean cup of water for humanity. They're not worrying about anything else. And within like Awaz and them's program, they have a occupation force out. It's not like they're trying to capitulate or align themselves with the imperial forces. Now let's move on to what else our brother Singh has to say. He also states that, quote, is it hypocritical of her to get money from the aggressors and give it back to its victims if there's no alternative source of money to help support these victims? I'm not advocating working within the imperialist system, but I am trying to point out that perhaps she had no options. Now, that's my point, unquote. She does have options. Well, she did have options. And part of it is locked within the battle that's going on within the trade union. Now, the trade union needs to expand itself. Many of these cats need to form a more strong workers' defense force to make sure that they physically preserve their particular interests, expand their program to start to demand more rights for the average citizen that's going on, to start redistributing the money that the corporations have stolen. And that's the only way that they can really get money that's stolen and wrestle a true economic safeguard of control of the society. It's not going to happen from a Marla's particular type of strategy, because that strategy is more of a strategy of collaboration than anything else. Now, another thing that this also helps expose, that I'm going to have to throw in there on the side, this helps expose the fact that, and I'm saying this for class reasons too, all these types that keep going on and on about Israel and the U.S. invaded Iraq for Israel and all of that, this helps expose this as a sham, because everyone knows now that, if they didn't know, that Iraq is in no position to attack anyone outside its borders. The Iraqi people can whip you up if you come within their borders, but no one's a threat to Iraq outside of its borders. Now, that being the case, if the U.S. empire invaded Iraq for Israel's sake, then why don't they leave now? Israel's more than safe. Why are they still there grinding? Because it's for the oil. Because it's for their class imperial interests. That's what they're there for. That's what they're always there for. Not the neocons' quote-unquote little agenda happen to coincide on a certain level with the big capitalists. Now, as long as it coincided with that aspect of their goals, cool. But they're staying there not because of Israel. They're staying there for their own economic domination of a vital resource that's reaching its peak level. This is class warfare. This is the real world. Now, what side are you on? That's what we slaves have to ask ourselves. Now, you also have a situation where... well, let me move on right quick. The brother also says this. Would it have been better off for her not to have acted? Well, it all depends on how you act. If you act in the interest, is what I'm saying, in a way that helps the masses of the resistant forces against the imperial structure, then I'm talking about something that's an action that I agree with. But if you're in action in collaboration with the imperial structure, then it's all a fraud. Now, the reason why I mention this again is that recently you have a situation where Halliburton, on May 18th, it held an annual shareholders meeting in downtown Houston. David Lazar, was congratulating himself on the $7.1 billion revenue the company had made off his recent work in Iraq. The number is double what the company made in the war-torn country the previous year. And it boasts Halliburton's overall revenue some 25%, bringing it to over $20 billion in 2004. Yet, at the same time, Halliburton is currently being investigated by, and we all know this is a joke, but the U.S. Federal Bureau of Investigations for Security and Exchange Commission's Halliburton's accounts filed a class action lawsuit in August of 2004. Alleging the systematic accounting fraud that they've been engaged in. Allegations of overcharging in Iraq persist from early 2004. Halliburton returned $6.3 million to the U.S. military. The company still hasn't repaid the $212.3 million to the Defense Contract Audit Agency, where they said that Halliburton overcharged. 60 of Halliburton employees were killed. There's a action against Halliburton by some of the victims' family members because they said, look, you misled those people. The reason why I'm saying this is that there's all types of actions against the imperial structures that she could have been engaged in. Over there in Iraq, aligned with the trade unionists to exert more and more influence and power for them to extract more money from the imperial structure with the overall goal, of course, of defeating them and crushing them. If you're not in that position at that time, you have to extract and take steps to increase your power base to win the confidence of the people. These are particular actions. In this country, align themselves with those of us who are engaged in breaking down the way that the recruitment of the masses of people of color and poor people are used as cannon fodder for the U.S. imperial machine. Now, this, like I said, means that she can't play her Mother Teresa role. This means that she has to just be a component with whatever ideas she comes up with, where you already have people of color who already have things going on in this particular case because it affects them most directly, already set up. But see, there's an attitude where many of these progressive types want to see themselves in the lead role playing Mother Teresa. Now, at the end of the day, if a slave came into the slave quarters after I've worked 20 hours on a slave plantation and hands me a piece of bacon and says, "Master told me to give this to you." Well, the reality is that you're not doing me any favors. You're doing Master a favor. Master gave you this to give me to help buy me off. He's not doing me any favor either. But if you come in here and hand me Master's head and say, "I just cut Master's head off," now we're talking about something. Now we're talking about something that goes beyond some kind of buy-off collaboration setup. Now, to continue on with Brother Singh's questions. He says, quote, "Did her working with the imperialists play a significant role in justifying their actions?" Now, significant, that's not really the question per se. And the reason why I say that is because if she is a talented, competent, somewhat intelligent person, what she's doing is diverting her energy and others like her from doing something much more constructive and something that would have a real impact. Now, he also goes on, quote, "Fine, yes, perhaps they use this collusion to partly portray themselves as humanitarians, but so what? It's bullshit. But so what?" Okay, no, it's not so what. And the reason why I say that, Singh, is because it's used to buy off progressives. It's used to undermine the development of many of us slaves who should be thinking in a collaboratory type of way with those of us who are under the boot. Where does our power reside? Our power resides within our labor. Whether you're a slave on the plantation in 1700 or a slave in Iraq. Handing out donkey chips to the darkies of the world doesn't help empower them. That does not help them bring any kind of power structure, aligning them with people who are in motion and in action for their class interests, like those trade unionists. That does empower them. That does help embolden the whole process. Now, Singh, he goes on from here and says, perhaps she made America look better in a very, very small sense to obtuse people who don't see the hypocrisy. But how did she impact the individual Iraqis that she met? She must have relatively improved the lives of some of the victims. And so if she hadn't acted, there would be more victims who were never noticed and never helped. All these victims care more about their immediate needs and their immediate tragedies than the class critique that you are offering. If a few victims were helped by her actions, then hurrah. Her positive contributions far outweigh her negative collusions. Now, what I have to say to that, Singh, is that it, as a Parente, and I personally didn't know that Parente had written this thing about Marla. I just came across it a couple of days ago when a friend brought this to my attention. But as Parente helped expose, she wasn't doing something that was really helping the people in any kind of even realistic way. This was basically her being handed out specific donkey chimps chips when at the discretion of the military, not even through Leahy, as we had been misled to believe. And then they were able to manipulate it in a way that they particularly wanted. The whole thing ended up being a fraud. So when you say that she must have relatively improved the lives of some of the victims, in reality, this shows to be somewhat of a farce. But we're talking about improving the lives of the people where their base of strength lies. And that's within alignment with a structure, elements within the Iraqi society, the trade unionists in the southern region that are able to make demands. They were able to not only get their salaries reduced, like Sam wanted, from 60 to 35, but pushed it up to 100, and now you have workers making $300 a month. This shows that they have Sam in a vulnerable position because of the crisis that the military's in, the chaos that's going in, and how bad they need this particular resource. This is how you can foment the power of the Iraqi people overall to crush the imperial structure. That's where the power lays, and that's where the victims can truly get some kind of justice within that base. Now, Brother Singh goes on and says, you mentioned that she had been an anti-war activist but decided to change things differently because she found it to be ineffective. The anti-war movement in this country has been marginalized and nullified so much that it is basically ineffective. So I guess my challenge is, if we do not want people to work with the imperialist nation, then we need to create alternative effective structures, but they aren't enough. And it's not so large scale enough yet, because we need more visionaries to encourage the building of these structures. I'm sure that if given the option, Marla would have preferred to work with another system, would have preferred not to work with the aggressors, but she didn't have an alternative structure to work with, and the people were being butchered. See, what I'm unquote. What I'm saying, Singh, is that it's clear now, as I just outlined, she did have alternative structures. She refused to work within those structures because of her own particular kind of petty bourgeois ideology. There is a power base and a power surge going on and struggle that's going on within Iraq on a class level. It's more than clear, and it's obvious she knew about this type of stuff. I mean, I can't see how she couldn't have. She was over there in Iraq long enough. The military was engaging themselves with the Iraqi unions and stuff. So why didn't she align herself on that class level? Why hand out donkey chips for the imperial forces? Why not support the movement that's in growth, that's in the crosshairs and has the imperial structures in the crosshairs? Now, it's interesting that a friend of mine went to one of these things recently where they were doing a kind of a celebration of Marla Rizicka, and he brought up some of the stuff that I'm outlining. And he heard the show, the previous show, and he ended up getting shouted down by all these liberals and stuff like that. Now, I'm open to people's ideas and so on and so forth, but how is it that we're being persecuted for questioning this kind of almighty sacred territory of this kind of progressive element that sees themselves in this Mother Teresa syndrome, where they go over to Palestine, they go over, you know, they have all these elements and avenues to address these issues right here and to align themselves with the forces that are in operation throughout the world. But instead, they align themselves with the imperial structure to play a Mother Teresa role, i.e. hand out donkey chips to the unwashed darkies masses of the planet. There's something that I think certain elements of the progressive movement needs to kind of re-examine. Why are they being so reactionary to some of the colored slaves in revolt, who question this type of model, Mother Teresa model, that we often see certain elements engage in? Now you have a situation where, as I wrap this up, in 1991, there were 1,800 healthcare centers in Iraq. Now, more than a decade later, the number is almost half, and almost a third of them require major rehabilitation. United Nations Development Program, which is the Human Development Index, that says that the country has fallen from 96 to 127, one of the most drastic declines in human welfare in recent history. Now, the reason why I mention that is this is another thing that Marla could have engaged in with the unions and other people who are fighting to rehabilitate these corroding, destroyed infrastructures of health. This is not some short-term thing. This is a real-term thing that those of Marla and other people's inklings, if they're truly sincere, could have engaged in. Now, that is gonna, we're more than over time, so I'm gonna have to wrap this up. But to Brother Singh and others, I appreciate your questions and stuff like that. And any types of questions that you may have, all they do for me is help me or force me or just have me sharpen up some of the things that I have said over the air, so to crystallize some of the ideas I have had. Hopefully this would have done this for Brother Singh, because at the end of the day, we're slaves in revolt. And as Singh says, I don't know, just some thoughts. Keep up the good work in solidarity. We're in solidarity because we know what side we're in and we know who the true enemy is. The question is that those like Marla need to. Hold on a second. All right, that's just going to about wrap it up for Slave tonight. It's clear that the model that the Marla Rizikas of the world is not the model that we're going to follow as slaves if we want emancipation. Because the reality is that the beast is shooting at us 120 times from Compton all the way to Iraq. And what we need to do is remain slaves in revolt. Until the next time, slave revolt.
A wild shootout caught on tape. A police call ends in this barrage of bullets. One L.A. County Sheriff's deputy is hit, and so is the driver at the end of a chase. CBS's Jennifer Davis has been on the scene all morning long. Jennifer, new information on the investigation.
Kent, Sheriff Lee Bakke is speaking in just a few minutes from Sheriff's headquarters. We're hoping he will give us some more information about the events that led up to the shooting. You can see the car is right behind where I'm standing, that car riddled with bullets. People who saw and heard what happened here early this morning say they still can't believe it, and this entire shooting was caught on tape. Deputies boxed in the suspect. When he didn't cooperate, the shooting started.
Deputies were at their car attempting to tase the suspect when the action that he took, and I can't explain what those were right now. We don't have
time to talk about that. Meanwhile, the government brings Star Wars from block to block. COP has an APBI on Chewbacca. Mr. Mayor, did I say something new? Anna, yesterday in Central Park, they got the jogger. Let's get the confusion straight and get on that. The man behind the mask. I thought it was Batman's Bill Clinton. He's super tired. The roof is on fire. Honey, tongue, brown, the bomb as it comes from Oklahoma. Things are getting serious.
When I left Alabama, Uncle didn't have any weapons on him. I know that for a fact. In the daylight, you can see the damage. Each white tag marks a shell casing. Neighbors are still stunned.
This was sad. I've never seen nothing like this. I never heard that much shooting going on. And the whole 47 years of my life.
Still a lot of questions to be answered. Now, we do know now the deputy has been released from the hospital. The suspect is in stable condition. We're live in Compton. Jennifer Davis, CBS 2 News.
What the fuck is my occupation? Well, I'm an MC. I'm down with the Fugees. Mother Mary caught a flashback like Rodney. Now the cops got lolly.
The subconscious psychology that you use against me. If I lose control, will send me to the penitentiary. Mm-hmm. It's just Alcatraz. I shot up like El Haj Militia Baz. Hot class can bypass when my ass gets harassed. Hey. And the fuzz treat bruns like they manhood never was. And if you too powerful, you get buzzed like Peter Tosh and Marley was. Yeah. And my word does nothing against the feds. So my eyes stay red as I chase crazy ball heads. Word up.
The beast is loose. On the town, the beast is loose.
The chase is on, I feel like the bad guy. Fifth gear, 125 like New Jersey driver. Looked in my rearview mirror, police was getting closer. Heard a roar in the sky, looked up and saw the blue thunder. My inner conscience says, throw your handkerchief and surrender. But to who?